Welcome to Stay in the Loop with Lucy, a podcast that is prepared to make us all feel a little uncomfortable. Not because there's anything particularly different about it, but, well, because it challenges what we have accepted as normal. Today's show comes back to the very basics in life, connectedness. Connectedness in end-of-life care. We're going to hear from Melinda and from Sally. It's a very personal story of care and the dying process. Melinda has been mentioned on this show before. Her husband, Philip, recorded an interview with me about writing his book, The Man Who Tried to Prove Too Much, which has since been published. Small plug there, available online and at all good bookshops. And if they haven't got it, please order it. Another plug. But in all seriousness, or slightly more seriousness, Melinda was there throughout the process. And what you will come to hear is something that was very natural to Melinda. The steadfastness that is her natural way, the simplicity she knew was needed to bring to the practical things that needed to be done, and the absoluteness to support Philip to embrace what was to come next, so he didn't need to worry about her or the children. Without further ado, let me introduce Melinda and, in time, Sally. Welcome, Melinda and Sally. So I am just going to warn the listeners that I think there's a very good chance that we're going to have a lot of tears through this interview. I suspect if Melinda doesn't go, then Sally will, and I will just be holding the space, hoping that I don't join them. But that's what happens when you get up close and personal to the most divine being who you will all have had the opportunity to meet if you've listened to his podcast, Philip Hills and the Man Behind the Mask, who spoke to us about all the things that he did to try and prove himself in life and how he felt that over time that contributed to, you know, having a stop moment in his life, he called it, that gave him an opportunity to really readdress a lot of those things before he passed over. He had a brain tumor, and I'm going to let Melinda tell us a little bit about that, but I think it was pretty hard going. And anyone who has supported anyone through a brain tumor will be able to understand and relate to what Melinda shares very deeply. Sally was the angel who came in to support Melinda when Melinda finally accepted that maybe she needed a little bit of help. Melinda, could you possibly share with us a little bit about what it was like in those first months of getting the diagnosis with Philip?
Sure, Lucy. It was a bit of a whirlwind, even though we were given amazing advice to, as much as we could, stay out of that whirlwind. I earned the name of the unstoppable force in that time because there was so much to do and Philip couldn't do as much. So it was like I was able to put my rockets on and just fire up and just, you know, do what we needed to do because there was a lot to do. But the initial weekend of diagnosis, the weeks leading up to it were pretty pretty raw in that we're going, what is going on? We just kind of knew something was a bit dodgy, and when he finally got the diagnosis, it was we certainly weren't expecting that. But yeah, you know, it was pretty huge that first weekend in hospital. It was during COVID, and so Philip had to stay in hospital for the weekend. He went in through emergency, and he had to stay the night by himself, and then I was able to join him at Chris O'Brien Lifehouse, which is right next door to RPA where he went to initially. And yeah, we just had a whole weekend just to ourselves because there's no visitors. And we mapped out what life could look like for us. He was given at best 12 months at that time. He got 24 months, which was pretty exciting. Yeah. So, you know, the first week was, we both had incredible amount of support to call upon, which did steady us in that, or help us steady ourselves in the eye of the storm that was absolutely upon us. And we did the surgery. He came home. He was pretty good for a couple of days because they pumped you full of steroids. And then the weakness started coming on, and then he started having treatment. And then as soon as he started having treatment, he started getting seizures, and in no time at all, he lost pretty much all function.
Melinda, were you working throughout that time, or at least trying to work throughout that time?
Because of COVID, I was working, but it was pretty bare in the books, if you like. For those of you who don't know me, I'm a physio, and in lockdown we could work, but it was, it was quieter, so I could block off big blocks, but I did work still, yes. We had 8 weeks in hospital with Philip completely losing all his function. So that was fairly full on, but we basically put our plan into action. We got him home and we realized we needed to move from our three-story place townhouse to a flatter unit, which Sal has come in and enjoyed while she was helping Philip in the end stages. But we got him home. He was still able to work a little bit. He started writing his book in that time. He started getting stronger in that time, and we sold our house and bought our new one, a new unit, and then got married and all those kind of things. So it was a pretty huge whirlwind. We did a lot, but it was literally like I had these retro rockets on and knew I just needed to do stuff and then we could settle. And settle we did, and it was a great thing that we did all those things when we did them, because by June of the following year he couldn't walk any meaningful distance. So the what we did in the time that we had it was very was good to do. In looking back, I kind of had a feeling we needed to do stuff because we just didn't know how long, one, we had him, and two, how long before his function would deteriorate, because he had a fairly nasty brain tumor.
So you were given a year, but oh my gosh, you know, already when we talk about life stressful events, that would have been one. Then you go and sell and move house, which is regarded as another very stressful event. And then you also get married, which is regarded as another stressful event. Now, can I just say that, you know, personally, I think all of those are just spectacular things to do and can be seen as stressful or not, depending on how you approach them. And you clearly are the walking, talking, living proof of that, because you seem to have taken it all in your stride. However, there is that, as you say, the pocket rocket, you just kept going and kept going and kept going, because it sounds like there was just simply no choice but to keep going, because at some stage you were going to find that Philip lost his motor function and his ability. How close to the year was that, or was it after a year?
It was pretty much smack on nearly a year. It was 11 months. He woke up one day in June, and I wasn't like, he was completely independent at this stage, so I could go to work. I went back to work fairly full time ish. He woke up one day, went to get up, but couldn't move his right leg. It just was that sudden. And it was after he'd had a number of colds. He'd had two colds, got over one, then had another one. So when you're on chemo, you're immune suppressed. So it was the first big things. But yeah, it was the biggest step down regression that we had. And at that stage, we finished the chemo because his actual brain tumor was shrinking where the original one was at the surgical site. But we just don't really know what happened at that stage. But he was not able to use his right leg after that. And so he really didn't walk. So life slowed down. And yeah, the inevitable slowdown occurred. So while those first few months were very, I want to say it sounds really busy, but we weren't going out per se. Like, it wasn't normal life. So we still had incredible amounts of time together, and we lived as normally as we possibly could in that time. But and we both do not regret what we did in that time. And yes, it is stressful moving house and so on, but it just so wasn't in the big scheme of things. And putting a wedding together, we had a wedding of 20, and I made it very clear that there was to be absolutely no stressing about it. So I only invited a certain number of people and made very clear, it's nearly like a terminal illness allows you to be a little bit cutthroat. it was just a very small wedding, very easy to organize. And we just had so much support. So it was, and then the inevitable slowdown occurred where we literally couldn't do too much at all with Philip. And once again, I had support to slow me down as well. And of course, towards the end, it was very slow. We didn't do too much at all. I didn't drive my car for about 3 months because I couldn't go anywhere too far away from Philip because he needed that 24-hour support, which is obviously where Sally came in to allow me to get out and about just a little bit.
When you were going to the hospitals and all the appointments, obviously you were there and went with Philip. How important was it to be with him, and what was the kind of upgrade that you had to do, or did you find you were doing in terms of understanding the pathology of an illness that you hadn't really understood before?
Important or not important, there was just no question that I would be there. Philip needed me for support physically, and his short-term memory was not so great. Long-term memory fine, hence why he could write his book. But there was just no question that I would not be there. So it wasn't even, I don't think importance is the word. It's just definitely was what was, our vows were, by our side, by his side, I would be by his side till the end and beyond. so they were moments that a lot of the things were telehealth as well, but his MRIs, you had to go into the hospitals and things like that. And we created a little bit of a, it's funny how you can routine things up. And there were times where we could spend time together. He'd come with me to pick up the girls because he could no longer drive, but he'd still come over to where they live in Randwick and back over and things like that. And they were beautiful times. Like, people think you've got to go out and have a, drink a lot of alcohol and go to amazing places to have a good time. That's not the case.
What I still have ringing in my ears is his sense of humor and his he was a very funny person and took joy in the little things. So I can completely see how just spending time together was very full for you both, which was beautiful. Very, you can feel that living on through you, which is really lovely. It's your normal. So you, when I knew you around that time, I remember there was a call to the friendship group saying, hey, I remember the email distinctly saying, this is not something I am comfortable doing, but I have been told I need to do it. I need to actually say I need some support. And it was beautiful to receive the email because, when you find out that someone has an illness that's going to require a fair amount of looking after and support, that's something that I think so many people don't necessarily know how to handle. And so they want to do what they can. I've done a recent interview with a woman who had breast cancer, and she said that it was really lovely to see how many people said, what can I do? But how is it to be on the receiving end of all those requests for what can I do? Is it hard to kind of manage your what you need, or would it be easier for someone else to have done that? Or what was that like for you?
So I probably didn't call for support until probably 3 to 4 months before Philip passed. And the one thing we didn't know was when he was going to pass. So, and when the next step down regression was and so on. We got NDIS help halfway through the first year of his life, which allowed us a few things. What did we do there? We had a carer that then would help take Philip walking once a week. We got some help. Well, I got some help cleaning the house. We don't have a big place, so that was okay. But even that, I didn't say yes to start with. The support coordinator kept ringing me and saying, "Mel, you've got cleaners. You can get a cleaner. Use it." And I said, "Oh, it's all right. It's a small place. I'm home a lot. It's okay." And then I realized, hang on, actually, that would be helpful. So I got that on board, and I definitely became a nicer person to be around with with the kids and so on. So yes, that was definitely needed. But yeah, I actually went to a dentist who's a friend of ours, and she I was having this problem with my tooth, and I just went and saw her thinking I was going to have to do drastic stuff with my tooth that was grinding. Like when I ate, sometimes it would just slip. And she just said, "Mel, it's about time you called on some support." And what she said was the teeth are one part of the joint for the jaw, the jaw's the next joint, and of course the head's the next bit. And she said, of course you're coping, you're coping very well, you can cope with this, but this is what's happening, and you need to have something left of you when all of this finishes as well. And so I understood that. I suppose the hard bit was that I didn't know what kind of support I needed. And she suggested, meals, and I thought, right, well, I'm not working as much. I'm still cooking. I'm okay to do this, but I just, did what she said, and basically said, all right, putting it out there. And I didn't know how much support I needed at home. We had a care worker coming in once a week, but even that, we didn't really need so much because Philip couldn't move so much by then. I was still able to get out. He was still somewhat independent. We could still do a few things together. And yeah, we were managing by ourselves, but I put that call out, and that very weekend I got delivered a beautiful slow cooked lamb, and it was amazing. And it was just so nice to be able to spend that extra bit of time with Philip in the afternoon, that I would generally be spent cooking. I didn't have to do that a lot. Of course, I was still cooking a bit, which is nice to be able to do, but I wasn't out at the shops as much getting food. It was a massive help. And the opening up the various things that people delivered to us was just, exploding heart kind of stuff. It really was. And I think it really blew my old way of thinking about help, that help's been very transactional in the past. If you, I used at this dinner party the other night the example of somebody, I've never asked anybody to help me move house, because if you ask somebody to move house, help you move house, and you're going to have to help them move house, and that's something I just do not want to do, so I've never asked. But it wasn't transactional. It was very much a whole friends community absolutely stepping up and wanting to step up. And of course, because there was such a group of friends, we it wasn't just one person doing a whole heap of meals. It was, I think we cycled through everybody once and maybe just a little bit more by the end of it. And yeah, it was pretty amazing. And then of course the help with I was needing to have gradually more and more people to come when I was at work, because Philip wasn't independent anymore. And so we had a carer come in through the NDIS in the mornings, and then I had, you know, one or two people coming in during the day. And then finally a friend said, what about Sal? And Sally came in three times a week, which was just amazing. And I completely had forgotten that she had a nursing background, and so she was absolutely perfect. And I had other friends do the other days. So yeah, it was pretty amazing. And on the flip side, it was hard to know exactly how much help we did need. You know, it all just worked out in the end. Because obviously Philip with brain cancer, he was sleeping a lot by the end of it, and who came in to help was important, because he couldn't talk very much by the end of it, and whoever was helping needed to be very sensitive to his energy levels and lack thereof, basically.
Perfect time to bring Sally in. I'm going to come back to you, Melinda, because I've got so many questions for you. But Sally, welcome. A friend said, what about Sally? She has a nursing background. Can you share a little bit about how you met Melinda, or maybe what Melinda was like when you first met her, to what it was like when you were then, coming into a very delicate situation, and whether there was a difference?
I'd love to share how I came across Mel. About 4 years ago, I remember it very, very well, in the beginning of 2019. I'd had back surgery. I had a lot of pain in my body, and someone happened to recommend the place that Melinda was working at. And so I made an appointment, and what they did at the time as a physio gave you a complete assessment, and I was very fortunate enough to have Mel assess me. And throughout that consultation, I felt a real connection with her, and it was very raw, because she was able to help me understand the connection between what was going on in my body, and it was amazing, absolutely amazing. Instead of thinking it's all just normal, you know, there were reasons why I had back pain and reasons why my knees were sore and my wrists. And so I started doing Mel's classes there, which I just absolutely loved. And I've been doing them for the last 4 years. And what Mel has taught me is the importance of being present in your body as you're exercising. So, you know, I'd done lots of different exercises over the years, and it was always my understanding that the harder you worked, the fitter you'll get, and the better your body will be. But of course, you know, what I learned through Mel's classes is that, you know, building hardness in your body certainly doesn't help in the long term well-being for your body. So it's been incredible, absolutely incredible. And Mel moved, she moved places that she worked, and because I just adored doing her classes, I followed her. So I got to know Mel very well and what was going on in her life, and she was very open with sharing different things during and after the classes with us all. And of course, when Philip got his cancer diagnosis, it was all very raw, of course. But as I noticed with Mel, is that what started to blow me away really was, you know, the way that she was handling, you know, the news, the treatment, the, you know, from a nursing perspective, you know, when someone gets a diagnosis that's terminal, you know, there's a lot of heaviness around that and people actually can go to pieces. And I noticed that Mel, she was talking about before, you know, she was a little, you know, put her rockets on and away she went. But it wasn't just in a hardened drive. She wasn't pushing herself. It just sort of became, right, there's things that need to be done. And she did it in such a caring, it's really hard to explain because I'd never witnessed anything like it, but it was like, you know, okay, this needs to be done. There was no drama around it and there was no heavy sympathy. And I just thought, wow, this is incredible. And as we, you know, as Phillip's, as he progressed and started to deteriorate towards the last few months of his life, when Mel was, you know, open to receiving a bit more help, and someone recommended me because I had the availability and also a bit of nursing background, you know, it was an absolute, and I'm going to cry, it was an absolute honour, because what it did for me is I've had, you know, I've dealt with death from a nursing perspective whereby, you know, people have a heaviness and sympathy and, you know, it's there's no surrender about the death process. And my own personal experience, I've had a lot of, you know, tragic deaths very close together in my life. So the way I learned to handle the tragic deaths in my life is I realized that, you know, you had no control over life and that, you know, no control over when you were going to die. So for me, I just held on to controlling things in my life even more. So I became very hardened in my body and almost living my life in fear. And the moment I walked into Mel and Phillip's apartment that very first day, I must say I could feel the bracing in my shoulders about what I was going to walk into. But there was just love and there was just joy. And I, you know, I really had to go, oh my goodness, like, I can't believe this. And what I learned over the period of time that I was able to spend with them both is I witnessed such love, such joy, but most importantly, the surrender around, you know, this is all part of life. We're brought into the world, we're born, and we are all going to die. And we all know we're going to die. However, we live with fear about that, a lot of us do. And Melinda was able to show me, you know, what I witnessed with them and the conversations they had with one another and how Melinda was able to prepare Phillip for the inevitable was just incredibly beautiful and enriching to be part of. You know, it was just, it's just changed my life and changed the whole way that I view death now. You know, I realize that death is not something to be afraid of because it's just a natural part of our life. And I saw how it could be so beautiful for everybody if there was surrender there on both sides instead of the fighting. You know, most of the deaths that I've witnessed through nursing have all been that's fighting till the end, that, you know, lack of awareness that, you know, this is all part of life, it's all natural. So it was really a beautiful, it was a gift that Mel gave me, just allowing me into a very private time between the two of them at the end stage of Phillip's life.
Thank you so much. What an amazing introduction, Sally. And you reminded me of something that Melinda said about, you know, that's just what you do when you get married through sickness and in health. But actually, there was no picture of that. What I heard in Melinda's voice, which I'm guessing everybody heard, was just that that's what needed to be done, and therefore it was done, and it wasn't done with a sacrifice or a picture of what she was having to give up in order to look after this man who she shared her life with. It was, this is just what we do for each other because we do. I don't think I can put words to it, and I don't think it needs words. It's literally just, this is what we do. The other thing I would 100% agree was, I didn't pick up any fight in Melinda or Philip when I interviewed him, and when he spoke about his illness, and he specifically said, I think he said that there was occasionally fighting that came up. Melinda, you may have to correct me. And then he was very quickly, either he or you were onto it, and realized that it was almost like he was being fed the fight, and that might have come from other people. Oh, fight on, mate, you know, you can do this. But actually, the moment that feeling passed, it was far more exhausting than just allowing the surrender of the process for the body to do what it needed to do. And that if that process was allowed to do what it needed to do, the it was less hard. Do you ever consider that the time that you knew Melinda, that there was almost a preparation for you to be able to then go into their home? Melinda was saying you had to be really sensitive to the energy that you brought into the home, because he was in such a sensitive state that he would have been aware if there was any push or drive in you. I picked up that all that work that Melinda did with you without ever knowing was almost preparing you to approach it in a slightly different way.
Do you know what? I've often thought about that myself, and I absolutely, I couldn't agree with that more. I feel that when Melinda said to me, you know, we'd love you to come and, you know, help us out so that I can go off to work, it felt so natural to me, because, you know, Melinda would be the first to tell you, in all the times I've been doing her exercise classes, you know, I'm probably the most talkative in the class. But I feel that I do know when to, when not to talk, when it's important that we're actually listening. And I just felt that Mel thought, yep, I'm practical. I have an ease of conversation with people. So it was a good fit. And you know what it was? It really was. Philip was very comfortable with me doing things that, you know, most people would find quite confronting if you didn't have a little bit of experience, having to toilet him and transfer him from the, you know, chair to the couch and make sure that he was covered and comfortable. And it was just all so natural to me. I just loved it, because it was the old style of nursing that, you know, I trained with. That's very different to today, because the nurses these days don't get much time to spend with their patients. And it just allowed me to, everything to be complete. There was no rushing. There was plenty of time. You know, are you comfortable? The conversations we were able to have, like, blew me away. I kept thinking, oh my goodness, they were fun. They were enriching. And they were so open and honest about what was happening. But I was able to do that because I watched the way Mel spoke to Philip. And I just thought, wow, this is incredible. You can say anything. It's okay to go there. How are you feeling? You know, how are you feeling about, you know, the time getting close? Which would be extremely confronting normally, but it was just amazing for me. Amazing.
You think we don't have those conversations about death enough and about what's going to happen, and therefore for the person that's dying and getting ready to pass over, that part of the fight is the fear of not knowing what's coming? And unless we get an opportunity to voice all of that and just wonder, just sit in the wonder of, I wonder what, or just the settlement of feeling what could come, that actually it increases that fear. You may want to join in here, Melinda.
I'll just say, Mel, before you jump on, that very much so. I've yet to come across anybody, you know, talking with friends, losing parents or whoever, that are so comfortable with the dying process, they're willing to have those conversations. And I can't help but feel that if you're not comfortable with the death process and what's happening to the body and the soul, that you carry that fear so that the conversations don't happen.
It was really interesting in the last, this year, 2023, which is the year he passed, and where we would be with certain people and the conversation would be just about normal stuff, which was important, but it was so not right because it was about the future they were talking about. It was about the things that, I don't know, it was a very strange thing. There was a couple of times and we realized we just could not be in those situations anymore where there was no sensitivity about where Philip was in his life. And we would go out with other people or be with other people and you'd still speak about normal stuff, but there was that sensitivity that Philip's not going to be here very much longer. It's nearly talking about somebody, and maybe it's like you're in another country and then people start talking about what's going to happen when you leave that country while you're in the country and you're not going to be in the country for very much longer. So it's completely irrelevant to them, but we're going to talk about it anyway. It's the first time I've used that analogy, but it was just a very weird thing. And so we could only have conversations that were very real and sensitive. And it was, yeah, and there was some people who could do that very well and there was others that couldn't do that, which was interesting. And Philip, when he was going into that phase of where he really couldn't get out and about much at all, he had a deeper sense of where he was going back then. He has written in his book, and I'm not sure if he spoke about it on the podcast, but he always knew that there was lives before, and he knew that there is going to be lives again. So, and that is something he brought with him to our relationship, and certainly was my view of what happens as well. Not everybody, what's the word, pertains to that view, but he could feel the other side. And I'm not sure what that is or what he meant. And we would talk about that, and the conversation would be not so much talking about that, but with the fact that that was there as the underneath. And as he got further and further along, he didn't feel that per se anymore. And it was kind of like he was already in the other side, on the other side, if you like. He was kind of straddling two worlds, and that was pretty precious and special to be with. And so the conversations you had with Philip were not the kind of conversations you have with the living, if you like. And so, yeah, it wasn't so much we were talking about death all the time, but just that it was nearly one life. It was kind of just all wrapped into what our reality was. And no, it wasn't doom and gloom. It was pretty amazing.
No, exactly that sense. Having been around someone who's passed before, it's when they're in and out of consciousness, but it's almost before then there's a detachment to this life that happens. And I love what you shared about in when you're in that end of life process or supporting someone, you cut the niceness, you just get to the point. And therefore, if you have people around you who kind of want to stay in that surface level niceness, then you just choose not to hang around with them in that process, because the space you have to communicate doesn't allow for that surface level conversation. And again, not all deep and meaningful conversations need to be super serious or heavy. They can be just spectacular. And I can see that in what you're, when you remember it. And it is, I love the idea of the idea that he didn't see it as something other. It became part of his now.
Yeah. Towards the end, he couldn't talk very much at all. So it was just the being together and communicating that way. But I do remember coming home one time from work and, Philip normally would have a sleep while I was away, but this time he didn't sleep. And of course, Sally and Philip were talking about his book. So he loved talking about his book. And they, Sally read, we had printed out a couple of pages because it was at the publishers by this stage and we were looking at different fonts and page layouts. And so Sal read that particular part of the book, and which then opened up this huge conversation for the both of them, which was just incredibly, I want to use the word healing for both, because we've often got very similar backgrounds that we don't often talk about in the living because, what is it? Is an often saying, the closer you get to death, the more alive you feel, and you're allowed to, as you say, go there with people where that may not have been the case. I know the guy who took the photos for Philip's book. Their conversations changed dramatically once Philip had the diagnosis, and they spoke about, just boy stuff, but then they spoke about, what was it like when you were growing up? What was it like when you did this and so on? And Sal and Philip got to share that as well.
So important for us all and for men in particular to allow themselves to have those conversations. Another opportunity you gave us all to really chuck out the normal and celebrate Philip while he was here was to have his end of life celebration. And I'd love to actually talk about that and you share what it was like to organize, what roadblocks maybe you came across, how it challenged people's perceptions. Perhaps Sally, you can share from your experience if there were any roadblocks from you or people going, wait, what? You're celebrating and he's his life and he hasn't died yet and I'm confused. Go for it, Melinda.
Well, Philip spent a lot of time on our lounge sleeping. We have floor-to-ceiling windows and it looks out onto other apartments. We are in a bit of a fishbowl, a beautiful expanse, very green and there's lots of sky, and that's where he would spend most of his time. So that's in smack bang in the middle of our place, a lounge, kitchen, dining area, and then we have an outside area. And this one particular day, Philip was donating his brain and spinal cord to research to his brain surgeon. So they had been in touch and they needed to know the funeral director. And so I was going, oh, shit, right. To this funeral director thing. God. I had a look at a few websites, made me feel quite sick. And then finally I rang somewhere where you seem to be able to do your own thing. It wasn't just the normal traditional thing. Anyway, this lady came over. She was a social worker in the past and she had dealt with this kind of illness that Philip had, and she had dealt with donations, brain donations. So anyway, she came, she was very lovely and I generally get on with most people and so on. And we walked outside, we met Philip and then walked outside so that Philip didn't hear the conversation. And we talked about, what could happen, what were the ins and outs and all that kind of stuff. And as we went along, I felt quite numb. There was something very wrong about this. I had envisaged what a funeral could be like for Philip. In the past, I had I'd already written the eulogy, I'd already said it to him over dinner with the girls here, and they just thought I was just crazy going, what are you doing saying all this in front of Dad? And I said, well, I want to make sure it's right, you know, you don't often get a chance to hear eulogies, so make sure that's all. He liked it and he did. And
yeah,
you know, they edited a few bits, and it's a bit long there, Mel, and so on. So, you know, I'd already had that. And anyway, I spoke to a few friends after this chat with the funeral director, and they just said, what about a celebration of life before he goes? And I had heard of this before, and Philip just got so tired when he was with one or two people, let alone, you know, 70-odd people that we ended up getting the following week together. But, yeah, we had to move quick because it was like he wasn't. He was going down fast. So, yeah, anyway, just I spoke to Philip about it and he just said, yeah, no, I wouldn't be able to do that. And then the next morning he said, actually, let's do it. And so I thought, right, people only generally have a week to organise a funeral, so I'll just see who I can get together in a week. And I put it out to certain people. I got those people to send off to their people, those people to send off to their people. My stepmom and my dad were a bit, oh, what are you doing? You can't do that. But, you know, I just reminded them that it was Philip's wishes. And, yeah, and then they got right behind it, which was amazing. We were all down, like we went to a local bowling club, and my stepmom went and got all the flowers from the markets and put all those together. My sister happened to be up, which is why I kind of planned it for that weekend as well. So we were all there very early in the morning at the bowling club because we had a 10 o'clock start, just putting tablecloths on things, getting flowers set up, setting up the chairs. And, yeah, it was pretty amazing. Yeah, just getting everybody together and, you know, family, friends in on board, and then a lot of people that Philip hadn't seen for a long time, that hadn't actually been in his life, but he did want to say goodbye to, but it wasn't about saying goodbye. It was really possibly even just dispelling some myths about somebody dying of a terminal illness, particularly the one about the fight and the struggle, and hence the celebration and not the sad goodbye. And we made it as such. It was very much where we wore rainbow colours, and I wore gold, pot of gold at the end, the rainbow. It was lovely getting ready with his kids, his two girls. It was beautiful. It was just, we're in the lift getting down to the car and just, wow, this is fantastic that we get to, you know, celebrate you and with all these people. And, of course, you know, when I introduced the day to the people that were there, I said loud and clear, you know, of course, these tears absolutely, you know, going to be around, absolutely welcome. Me and Philip will start you off. But it's not about goodbye today. You know, Philip's not dead yet and he's not going to die just yet. He will. You know, if you need to get in touch with him, send him an email on Facebook, you know, give him a call, feel free to do that. But this is about celebrating his life. And, of course, we're then able to, you know, to have it. I said the eulogy and he was able to say he's to Bobsworth, whatever he wanted to. He had a good cry. We all had a good cry. Yeah, it was lovely to have him involved in it. And then, of course, the lovely Lucy read out the last chapter of his book, because that was a really good wrap up or summary summary of where he was at, for those of people who hadn't seen him for a very long time, and for those, even the family and friends that we had around, to be able to say, yeah, this is this is the reckoning that Philip's had with his life, and this is where he's quite settled, where he's going as well. So it was pretty, it's a pretty powerful day.
It was a super powerful day. Thanks, Melinda. Sally, what was it like, bearing in mind you'd had quite a few people pass in your life, and so therefore quite a few funerals and things like that? How was it accepted or responded to in your house?
Yeah, it was really interesting because I've grown up in a very Catholic environment, and all the deaths that I'd been through, those personal deaths, were all very much around, you know, the funeral after the person had died. And so that when Mel sent out this celebration of life for Philip while he was still alive, it felt so natural to me. And I thought, wow, I've never heard of that before, but what a beautiful idea. However, anyone that I happened to have mentioned it to, you know, the consensus was, well, that's a bit weird. And I said, well, watch this space. So going along the day of the celebration, I kind of had no idea what to expect, but it was the most beautiful day, and it was in the middle of this gorgeous park and the sun was shining. And, of course, I'm so used to big Catholic funerals whereby you have to turn up really early or you won't get a park. So I turned up fairly early and I thought, oh, there's plenty of parks around here. Okay, well, I'll just go in and find where this is going to happen. And there was no one else around. I was the only one there, and there was an older man sweeping the path. And I said to him, oh, is there an event here today? And he said, oh, yeah, they were here earlier on to set up. And he said, I think they've gone off to the funeral. So I had a little chuckle to myself and thought, no, it's not a funeral. He's still alive. But what blew me away from not knowing what to expect was the joy and how uplifted I felt. I've never experienced anything like it. It was just the most beautiful thing to witness. And it was so, you could see the joy on with Philip on having all the people, the special people in his life that were there, instead of, you know, how many times, the number of times actually I've been to a funeral where you say, you know, gosh, I wish Dad was here to have witnessed all these beautiful people coming to say farewell. And yet all those people were surrounding Philip on the day, and Mel and the girls. And it was just beautiful to watch. And the way the girls handled it all, I thought, like, this is the next level norm. This is just what, you know, this is such a, like, they were such role models in the way they handled the death, the celebration, and even Mel particularly for after Philip had passed. It's just a whole new way of being comfortable with death and feeling the joy and the celebration of, yes, you are here and you're passing on, but, you know, your life was worthwhile. It was, yeah, it was amazing. And when I came home, my family, all, how did that celebration, the weird thing that was going on today, and I was able to say to them and many others it was the most amazing thing. And people actually don't say it's weird anymore. They just say, wow, it's almost like society would never think of doing something like that. And it just felt so comfortable. And when I say that to people, like, why not? And I just know that, you know, the seed has been planted out there to say there is another way of doing death. So, you know, it was another amazing experience.
Yeah, I came back and said, guess what, guys? That's exactly what I'm having. There's no chance of me being around after I've died. I'm out of here. So if, you know, let's same for everybody. If we're in a position where we've got someone we dearly love who's passing, then why not say everything? Why not let them hear everything? Then they go off and they don't hanker after what wasn't said. You know, just say it all, get it out, resolve whatever needs to be resolved, and then don't look back. That's what I felt he could do. Is you gave him every opportunity, Melinda, to say everything that there was to say, to the point where he knew that words would never communicate what, because, I mean, honestly, words are such a reduction of what we can communicate anyway. But it, yeah, to me, you just gave him the space to just express himself. I love the fact that he spent a lot of the time interjecting and interrupting, throwing in his one-liners and bursting into tears at the drop of a hat and then saying, oh, it's my hormones.
Yeah. And it is interesting. His sister just had a birthday and I had gone through his Facebook photos because I was trying to find a photo. And there was a photo, it was way back, a couple of, you know, about 6-7 years ago, and there was a photo I was after. But I saw a photo of Philip cheersing his, like, from a photo, like, he took a selfie of himself, of course, but with a beer in his hand and, you know, cheersing his sister's birthday. And it was probably about 5 or 6 years ago. And she put on her Facebook this time round and posted exactly that photo, which I'd just seen the day before. And she said, I just so wish he could send me a photo like this again. And it was, there was regret there. And, you know, we just didn't have that because we were able to say, I'm not sure, maybe there wasn't regret, but it did seem like that. But we just didn't have that because we were able to say and express everything that was needed. Nothing left on the table.
What's it been like since Melinda?
Oh, you want me to cry again? Oh, very up and down. Yeah, I cry at a drop of a hat. I miss him incredibly.
Mm.
But it's been okay at the same time.
Mm.
We had a lot of time to prepare. Nothing really prepares you for when they actually go.
Mm.
Nothing. Yeah, it's you know, but I know he's gone. I know he's not around. But what we live together is still with me.
And indeed, so much so that you have managed to fit into a lot of his clothes and tailored some of them. So he is definitely with us here today. What the listeners can't see is that you're wearing his awesome stripy shirt. The other night I saw his amazing leather jacket on someone. You have tailored his trousers and he, you know, the heavens are shining on us right now because I'm going to be completely blinded by the light coming through the window, which hasn't been around before now. So yes, it's very much the little bits that can stay with you. Very beautiful. Is there anything that you would like to share to complete today that you feel it would be important maybe for someone, maybe who's at the start of the journey or the middle of the journey? What would you share with them as the person who's supporting? Because it's a whole different conversation when you're the person who is passing. And I've done interviews like that before, but the person who's supporting very rarely gets the opportunity to share, you know, what it's like. And it's a whole different kettle of fish because you live on.
Yeah, there's probably a lot there. There's something that did come, but it was, you know, one of the biggest things was not to project, to live without looking forward, and therefore you just lived every day. And however, with a terminal illness, you have to prepare. So you do have to look ahead. For example, what supports do you need? when they're going to happen and so on. So in our case with brain cancer, nobody really knows what you're going to need when, because everybody's trajectory is very unique. It was really to stay in the eye of the storm. So when you go out, you get buffeted by the storm and you don't know which way's up. So coming back in and just going moment to moment, you could actually move within the storm with relative ease. Towards the end, we had no idea that hospitals in Sydney, at least, for palliative care, you could only be in there for 2 weeks. So just when you're just really settling with, wow, you know, Philip was in hospital for 2.5 weeks before he passed, and we made the decision, a huge decision, to go into palliative care because I could no longer handle him one-on-one by myself, whereas before I could transfer him with one person, just with me. So I needed extra help, and also at night was because he was at night was so I we could have maybe done it at home, but it would have been we would have needed 24-hour care, which is what hospitals are for. So we went into hospital, but yes, just that, you know, he got into hospital, he slept and slept, and then he recovered a bit and then he went back, and you know, it was back and forth a little bit, not back and forth in the hospital, but just in his status, if you like. Just when you don't know what's going on and you really need to settle and be in the eye of the storm, you get a phone call to say, oh, we might be moving Philip on. And
from a human being saying we're going to move him on because he is not moving on fast enough.
Oh, that's right. Yep, exactly. So anyway, that was an experience and a half. And towards the end, I probably it was hard to know who to listen to. You literally did just have to be there, and that was the biggest thing, is just to be responsive to whatever was happening. And the last day is still plays on me. And I, you know, in hindsight, I would have loved a little bit more explanation of exactly what happens on people's last days, because when I chat to people who have had people die similar things, because a lot of people die from terminal illnesses, it's a very similar process, yet that actual last day isn't talked about, and that would probably be something that I think would have helped. Of course, that's in hindsight, and we don't know if, nobody even knows what the last day is, but just knowing what a last day could look like, I feel like I could have been a little bit more prepared. But then again, the last day was our last day. Our last conversation was our last conversation, and it was how it was. And how it was meant to be. He was just incredibly beautiful.
I have no doubt from what you've shared that the final conversation you have had would have been everything. Just as the first conversation you had was the same, because that's the way you both lived together. It was just one conversation, regardless of the outcome.
Yeah. It was very beautiful.
Deeply adore you, Melinda. Thank you so much for sharing your story with us. And thank you, Sally, for being part of sharing, you know, how amazing Melinda was how amazing Philip was, and the three of you together, how you managed to bring a huge amount of light to a process that can be quite dark if it's chosen that way.
Yes, thank you, Sally. Thank you, Lucy.
Oh, thanks, Mel, for allowing me into your life at that period of time. And thank you, Lucy, for allowing me to share what it was like.
You have been listening to Stay in the Loop with Lucy.